somebody brought this up asking me if there have been any programs that allow foster children to take their pets with them. And that wasn't an idea that I've ever thought of, and I don't think it exists, but what a great idea.
Welcome to the Animal Academy podcast. I'm Allison White, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in the human-animal connection. This podcast will showcase professionals who share their areas of expertise in an ongoing series of interviews, and you are there. Their input, stories, and knowledge will help us all understand that we are the ones that actually end up learning from the animals. This is the Animal Academy Podcast. Hello, everyone, and hope all of you are doing well. I can't believe the year is almost over as we continue with the holiday season. This has been a very hard year for everyone, and I hope you're staying safe and practicing good self-care. Today's interview continues our discussion with another professional in the field of veterinary social work, which is a growing field as more people are recognizing the important role animals play in the healing process. I will be speaking with Dr. Bethany Poe, who will be sharing some powerful stories as part of her work with the University of Tennessee's programs and animal-assisted interventions that help people in their healing journey. Bethany, welcome. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the work you're doing.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell me a little bit about how did you get started in the field?
Sure. Well, I think my story is a great example of the idea that you will eventually end up where you're supposed to be. I started my master's program at the University of Tennessee's College of Social Work in 2005. And at the time, the college had two tracks, micro and macro, which they called clinical or management and community practice. I came in my master's program thinking I wanted to be clinical, social worker, eventually have a private practice doing therapy, particularly with survivors of abuse. However, during my first internship, I quickly discovered that that actually was not a good fit for me. I did not enjoy it at all. So I switched from clinical to the management and community practice track. And at the time, I had actually planned on going to law school after I finished the master's. And it got to be time to select my second internship for the master program. And I was planning on going to a local child welfare agency. I thought that would be a good fit for my next step going into law school. And it turned out that particular agency didn't want a macro intern that year, which was disappointing at the time. Well, thankfully, our field coordinators were very wise and made us pick second and third choices. And my second choice was veterinary social work. I listed it as my second choice because I've always been an animal lover, and it was something relatively new. Veterinary social work program at UT was about 3 or 4 years old at the time. And I just thought, why not? I need an internship. That'll work. And of course, the way it works, the rest is history. I loved it. And I never actually really left. So I graduated in 2007. I came back to the program as a PhD student in 2008. And I've been involved in some way ever since.
So what made you decide this is it for me?
It let me blend all the things I was interested in. Dr. Elizabeth Strand, as you know, started the University of Tennessee's Vet Social Work Program. And she is really an excellent mentor and really asked what I wanted to do, what I was interested in. And I was interested in the link and I was interested in policy. And she said, okay, well, let's find you something to do. And she let me do it. My major project that year, I had a class that was advanced policy practice, and we actually had to pick a bill that was up in the Tennessee legislature that year and advocate for it. And luckily for me, there was actually a bill that allowed pets to be put under orders of protection for domestic violence victims that was up that year. And so that was my project and advocating for it. And I'm very happy to say it did pass. And so, yeah. So we've had pets in orders of protection since 2007 here in Tennessee. And it just let me do everything I wanted to do. I help people and I help animals. And it's different. It's evolving. And it's just a perfect fit.
So Bethany, when you mentioned the link in other podcast episodes, specifically with Phil Arco, few months ago, and also Dr. Pam Linden, we talked a little bit about that as well. People may not know what the link is. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. So the link is the short term for the link between human and animal violence. And all that really means is that violence does not occur in a vacuum. If you're going to find one type of abuse, you're probably going to find another. So the link is the term we use for the connections between domestic violence or interpersonal violence, whichever term you prefer, child abuse, elder abuse, and animal abuse.
Well, and thanks for sharing that. And one of the things that popped into my head when you were talking about the program and choosing the link is when I was going through the certificate program, that was the one class that I waited until the end to take. You know, I'm just going to be right out there and honest with you. It was a very difficult one to even comprehend going through. I'm glad that I was able to finish all aspects. And then also during our intensive, got to meet with people who really specialize in that. And it's a very needed profession, you know, part of the program, because it helps protect both kids. It also helps protect the animals. Unfortunately, there isn't a standard of care across all states, right?
No, there's not. Not yet.
Are they working on that?
I think that's sort of the vision. I don't know of one consolidated effort, but I think a lot of us that work in the field have that vision where including animals in all the violence fields is just automatic. That you just do it. It's standard practice. But we're still working towards that.
Got a long ways to go, though.
We do, unfortunately. But I think there has been a lot of improvement. When I first started this, I hate to age myself, but you know, that was 2006, 2007. It's 14 years later. And when I first started it, a lot of people, even if they were in the field of social work, kind of questioned, you know, why are you talking about animals? Why are you doing this? There's other things we should be doing. And, you know, why does this matter? And now the conversation is a little different. People are, even if they haven't heard of the link, they, once you bring it up, they're aware of, oh, that makes sense, that people are attached to their animals. We need to think about what a difference a pet can make. That attitude has changed. A lot of the laws have changed. You know, when we first started, I mentioned that Tennessee got its orders of protection law for pets in 2007. That was pretty new. There weren't very many states that had done it. And now I think there are about 35 of them, I think. So, you know, I think we have a long way to go. I think in domestic violence, we're making strides. We still have a lot of ways to go when it comes to child abuse, I think. It's still not an area that we necessarily think about when we're working with kids who are being abused or thinking to ask kids about, are they abusing animals? And also, you know, somebody brought this up at the Vet Social Work Summit a couple months ago, asking me if there have been any programs that allow foster children to take their pets with them. And that wasn't an idea that I've ever thought of, and I don't think it exists, but what a great idea.
That would be awesome.
Wouldn't it? So, you know, we have a long way to go. And even with elder abuse, I think we have a long way to go in elder abuse in general. A lot of people don't think about it. They don't know about it. And they haven't even came up with a concept of including the animal and thinking about the animal. So there's a lot of room for growth in this area.
There is a tremendous amount of growth, but at least the conversations are happening. I think that's the first step.
Yes.
So one of the things that, you know, is part of the assessment process is identifying who in the family is there, who are the important members of the family. And, you know, and that includes all of the cats, all of the horses, all the dogs, whoever, guinea pigs, whatever, because those are important parts of all the family members' lives.
Exactly. And we're still at a point that if you don't ask, you're not going to know in a lot of cases, because we still have some attitudes about people who are quote unquote obsessed with their pets. You know, the crazy cat lady stereotype is still there. We still have, I think we've kind of expanded that into crazy dog lady too. So we do get victims sometimes who the animal is a big concern for them, but they don't necessarily want to say it. Because they're in this dangerous situation, they should be thinking about themselves, but they're worried about the dog, and they're afraid they're going to get judged for that. Or, on the other hand, they just think that that's not even a possibility, that they don't know that there might be a service available to them that could help the animal. So So it's really important as a service provider that we ask, say, you know, do you have any pets that you're concerned about? And start talking through what the options might be.
Well, and the very first thing that you said was they're almost afraid to comment about it and bring it up. That's part of that stigma, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's stigma issues all over violence issues. So the situation itself, there is a lot of stigma about being in a violent relationship. How was I so stupid? Why do I stay? All those kind of questions. People are going to judge me for this. And then we add another layer of animals on there where we have stigma about that in some cases. So it's just good to ask. And the reality is too that everyone is different. For some people we ask, are there any pets? And they can say, yeah, there's a dog, but that's not really a priority. Mm-hmm. And that's okay too. Mm-hmm. But if we don't ask, we're not going to know.
Well, I'll tell you what. I worked in a community mental health agency for over 25 years. And so we did community outreach to people that had severe and persistent mental illness, large homeless population. And there was a lot of stigma attached to people who could barely pay for their own rent and food, also having pets. And so there was a lot to overcome with that. I connected with Bi-State Food Pantry in St. Louis, Missouri, and worked out an agreement where we could actually go and pick up some food for their cats and their dogs as a way of getting us in the front door for people that really did need mental health treatment, but didn't really trust us. So they did trust us if we had some treats for their dogs or cats because they were so important to them. We were able to get in the door. We were able to help them get the health care that they needed. The problem was, is that a lot of them would then need hospitalization for health, you know, mental health reasons, but then there was no one to take care of their pets. Or they were in a domestic violence situation and they didn't want to leave that because of their pets. So talked to Animal Protective Association in St. Louis and found out that they actually have a grant for domestic violence victims where if they call and say, I'm ready to leave this abusive relationship, they would then take in their pets and, you know, board them and, you know, even birds, they can find homes for them until the person gets into a safe house and then they can reunite them later. I think that is the most awesome program ever. And I wish more shelters would have that.
Yes, that would be awesome. You addressed a lot of different issues right there. So one thing is that going back to the stigma and a lot of things people don't realize, especially with domestic violence, is that pet may be the only emotional support left. A lot of abusers isolate their victims. So that dog or cat or bird may be the only companion that victim has left. In some cases, it may actually be a source of protection. There have been lots of cases where pets have gotten in between a victim and the abuser. And then the other issue you bring up is housing. Housing is always an issue with this topic. There are resources. It depends really where you are, unfortunately. The resources vary a lot. So there are a few different models for this. So some domestic violence service providers do have shelters where they can also include the animal. New York City has a great program, actually. Federally, the Office of Victims of Crime just released some funding to do some kind of pilot programs. There were 6 awards for that. The funding originally came from the Pets and Women's Safety Act. Nashville was actually lucky. One of our domestic violence shelters got some of that funding. So they're really? Going, they did. So awesome. It's the YWCA of Nashville and Middle Tennessee. They got funding to build some additional kennels onto their shelter so mm-hmm. that they can actually house animals on the same property. Mm-hmm. Which is going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
Other places, they use kind of a fostering model. So they may have relationships with either the animal shelter or a local rescue organization to sort of board the animal while the victim is in whatever safe house shelter situation they're in. And there's also a model where funding is provided. So the victim receives money to board the animal. There's some different options, but unfortunately, they're not as common as we'd like them to be.
That sounds like a wonderful model. And I was just thinking about some of the obstacles that we had when we were working with people that didn't have vaccinated cats and dogs. So now they're requiring hospitalization or they're decompensating and their cats or dogs are not vaccinated, then what? Because nobody's willing to board them. So that started my community service project with the University of Tennessee. That's actually what I worked on. That's a whole other podcast in itself. So I won't go off on that.
That sounds great. And it's an excellent point. You know, we need all these different pieces because housing is not the only issue. You know, public health is also an issue. So, you know, making sure the animals are healthy enough to be in a shelter, whether that's an animal shelter or a people shelter, that they have their vaccinations, that they have parasite preventative or control if, you know, you don't want your shelter getting flea infested. So we have to think about those things. And sometimes we don't when we're jumping in. Mm-hmm.
So we know what the end goal should be. It's just getting there, right? Because there's so many pieces of the puzzle that need to fit together.
There are, yeah. And I think we're making progress in that way. There's still a lot of education that needs to happen. You know, there's a high turnover on both sides, animal welfare and domestic violence service providers, child abuse service providers. So that education has to be ongoing and it needs to become standard.
Mm-hmm. So that brings up, you know, an important question. How do people stay in the field?
That's a really good question. I think part of it is passion. You have to really be invested, I think. I used to teach bachelor's social workers and they always said, you know, I don't know what to pick. And I was, for me, anyway, my experience was it clicked. You could do lots of things. You might have been good at lots of things, but there was something that made you light up. I think once you find that, that helps. But then self-care is always important. For me, that it means basics. So I make sure that I get enough sleep. I make sure that I eat things that are actually nutritious. And I have to do things that don't involve screens for a while, whether that's cooking or crafting, but I need to do things. So, and also recognizing when you need a break, and that's okay to have a break.
It's a field where the work is endless. It's never ending. And so it's hard to know that your day is done when there's one more animal that needs to be rescued or a situation that needs to be taken care of. So it's knowing where your limits are.
Knowing where your limits, having good boundaries is always important. And also I think having small goals helps. If we just look at this giant goal of having every agency have animals included in their standards of practice, that's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful, but it's overwhelming. If you break it down to what's happening in my town, what's happening at my domestic violence shelter, what's happening in my state, that's easier.
Mm-hmm. I always thought about, you know, I used to tell the staff on my team as well is don't focus on the outcomes. I mean, you need to know what the outcome is that you want to achieve, but all along the way, focus on the little steps that will help get you to the outcome. Because if you're focusing on the outcome all the time throughout the day, you get hung up on that and never feeling satisfied with the work that you're doing.
That is a very good point. Yes. Those little steps. And making those goals and celebrating those every little inch.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think realizing that's something I've had to learn, I'm still learning, is that progress is a lot slower than you think it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting used to that and accepting that, that's still something I'm working on.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on that as well. So. So Bethany, you're currently the Middle Tennessee coordinator for UT's Human Animal Bond in Tennessee, the HABIT program. And you're using animal assisted interventions to help victims of violence, abuse, and neglect, right?
Yes, I am.
So what do you do in that role?
So as a coordinator, it is my job to recruit, train, screen, and match volunteers that have medically and behaviorally screened dogs, cats, or rabbits with agencies that want visits from HABIT animals. I work with both the volunteer, figuring out what it is they want to get out of the program and what's appropriate for their animal, and also working with the agency, which is something I think makes HABIT really unique, is that we make every facility that wants a HABIT visit go through a process where they fill out an application, they make a protocol, which we provide a model, but they really have to think through what it is they want out of these visits and what's going to work in their agency. Because the reality is not every therapy animal is the same, which if you think about it, makes sense. And so we need to really think through what is it we're looking for. And then it's my job to match what they're looking for with what we have and put them together.
I think that's really cool. I got on the website earlier and I looked at the different programs that you are offering and that you work with. And also it said, if you're interested in having this program or the habit program come into the agency, this is what you need to think about and fill out. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Some basics. What is it you're looking for? Do you want the animal to come visit a client one-on-one? Are you looking for an animal that's good with groups? Is there a big space that we have to work with? I have one agency that's waiting for a volunteer because their facility is tiny. Like, if I let a golden retriever in there, it would take up all the floor space, basically. So I need a tiny dog for that. And you know, they have different personalities, different fits. And in Middle Tennessee, we're a little different because Habit does all the traditional places you think of therapy animals going. So schools and hospitals and nursing homes, all that. But we actually got a grant from the Tennessee Office of Criminal Justice Programs to bring these therapy animals into agencies that work with victims of crime. So specifically violence, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault. And so we're a little different in that we focus on those agencies. So most of my volunteers go to places like domestic violence shelters, the Family Safety Center in Nashville. We have several that go there. Juvenile court. We have some that go work with residential facilities for adolescents that are in custody, in state custody. We are focusing on those agencies in particular.
So when you choose a dog to go into one of those facilities, is there a certain temperament that you're looking for?
All of our dogs, we're looking for that they are even keeled. We need them to be interested in strangers. We need them to be calm. We need them to have good manners. So they need to walk well on a leash. They need to be able to sit and obey, not be tearing things up, that sort of thing. No jumping, no barking, that sort of thing. For these agencies, it depends on what agency it is. But some things, the physical space matters, you know, for size of the animal. Other things like juvenile court, for example, we have a lot of people in fancy suits because they're about to go in court. I can't have a dog that's going to shed all over them.
Sure. Yeah.
So the dogs that go there, they need to be pretty calm. They need to be not so sheddy. Some of my others, with the ones that go see the teenagers, they're a little bit more active. They're a little bit more alert. We don't necessarily play, but they, you know, they're very interested. They move around more. Some of our dogs that go to the Family Safety Center, they just want to lay there and let people pet them, which is great because a lot of times we have children there that maybe have witnessed a violent situation or something, and they just need to kind of lay there on the floor with the dog. You know, we really try to fit it down to what is the population, what do we want the animal to do?
I was thinking about my golden retriever, who's a certified therapy dog, and I used to take him into a children's home. And I would just pray whenever he would get fixated on one of their toys, I would just pray that he wouldn't lunge at the toy. So I really was on even more than my dog was to make sure that he behaved. But he seemed to know when it was his working, you know, time.
Yeah, they really do. They in Habit, they wear a red bandana that has our Habit logo. And they also have an ID that they wear while they're on their visits. And almost all the dogs recognize that, oh, okay, we're going to visit now and we need to behave ourselves. You know, it was so funny. Part of my job is also to observe at least the first visit, usually a couple of them, to make sure it's smooth, that it's a good match. And we went to this one particular domestic violence shelter. It looks like a house and it has a yard in the back. And after the visit, my volunteer is walking their dog on the leash and his bandana happened to fall off. And the minute it fell off, he started running around in circles. It was like, whoo, it's playtime.
I'm free.
Yeah. And he had been a perfect gentleman while he was working. But the minute it was off, it was playtime.
So who joins Habit as a volunteer? Who is that comprised of?
We have pretty big variety. Here in Middle Tennessee, we've got a lot of people who are in some way related to helping professions. So I've got a few social workers. I've got some therapists that use their animals in their practice. But in general, it's adults, a lot of them work and they have some free time. They have some flexible schedules and they just have a really good heart and want to give back.
Awesome.
So,
do you have a training program that you go through with the dogs?
So all of our volunteers go through a orientation where we explain what we expect and go through the requirements. It is up to them to, if they feel like they need extra training, they can pursue any sort of obedience class they want. We do an evaluation. So we have some behavior evaluators that put the dogs through paces and make sure that they're going to be appropriate. And so we don't do their full training, but we do the evaluation part.
Okay. So when you say that you use animal-assisted interventions, that's a little bit tricky too. So what kind of interventions do you use with an animal?
So most of our animals are used for animal visitation. So it's mostly animal-assisted activity would be the appropriate term if we're going to get technical with it. Most of them are used just to be a calming influence. One thing all of our agencies have in common is the people there are stressed out. So whether it's a school, a hospital, a courtroom, a nursing facility, whatever it is, those people need to have some de-stress time. These animals go in as a source of calming, relaxation, sometimes distraction. And also in a lot of cases, it's social interaction. Animals always provide that social lubrication. It's something we can talk about. We have it in common. And for a lot of folks, they don't necessarily want to think about whatever it is that they're in that agency for right now.
And it's very non-threatening. So
it's non-threatening. It doesn't matter what they say. The dog is not going to judge them and it can help build that rapport. So for a lot of, we have some therapists, as I said, that use their dogs in practice. Calming, but also building that rapport because it gives those subtle cues that, well, if the dog likes this person, the person's probably okay. Maybe I could talk to them. And in some cases, we found that it helps the person start talking and they can start talking to the dog. Like they know the therapist or the advocate or whoever is there, but they're talking to the dog and it feels easier to talk to the dog about all those bad things. So it just kind of smooths the way.
And I think that's why they're starting, or they have been using dogs in courtrooms with kids, right?
Yep.
It's easier for the kids to talk to the dog that is then recorded for the court to hear.
Helps keep them calm. You know, we actually had a case with the Family Safety Center in Nashville. Our dogs go on routine visits. They go about once a week. And this particular one, the dog's name is Polly. She is a little miniature golden doodle. Mm-hmm. She's about the cutest thing you've ever seen. And she went in for her routine visit and one of the therapists came out and said, hey, we have this guy having a panic attack to the point that we're about to call an ambulance. Can the dog come in here? Polly went right to him, sat down next to him. He started petting her. Within 20 minutes, he had calmed down enough that he could continue the session.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And it lets us know, because the reality is that for this person, if they had had to call an ambulance, that would have been another financial hit, because ambulances are not free. Mm-hmm. That's another stressor, because now we have an ambulance ride and a hospital visit, and who knows where that hospital visit's going to go. We now associate the Family Safety Center with this bad experience we've had. Who knows if this client's ever coming back? This time, didn't have to call an ambulance, was able to stay in the session, finish talking to the advocate, and move forward.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's huge.
It is huge.
You know, and we've had so many of the staff say, you know, we have clients that schedule their therapy sessions based upon when the dogs are going to be here. Mm-hmm. They've had clients that literally got up out of talking to an advocate to go pet the dog, which was a bit of a problem, actually. But it made it going to somewhere to talk to professionals about what's been happening to you can be daunting and stressful. And we have people that are willing to go to the center because they might see the dog.
Well, I was always asked to bring my Golden Retriever Charity to the mental health center, specifically for kids when they're waiting for to see their psychiatrist. And so I would hang out in the waiting room with the kids and they would pet the dog. And my dog actually did this little army crawl across the waiting room. They thought that was hysterical. I remember seeing the psychiatrist in the elevator leaving And he said, I heard that you saw my patients before I got to see them. And I said, yeah, we were called in to keep them calm for the visit.
Exactly. You know, keeping them calm. In some cases, it's keeping them distracted. So we have a lot of clients that the adult, the caretaker needs to talk to the advocates or the attorneys, whatever, but they don't have any childcare for their kids. The dog is a good distraction for the kid. They're not trying to find mommy all the time. So it can be really helpful.
That's awesome. Do your dogs go through any kind of canine good citizenship training, or do you do anything specific?
So our evaluation is very, very similar to the canine good citizen. Most of them have been trained. The evaluation is very, very similar.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So what are the outcomes, do you think?
We have a lot of anecdotes about what the dogs mean to people. We're still working on figuring out a really good evaluation. But routinely, we have people say, you know, this is the best time of the day. This is the best time of the week when the dogs come visit. So,
well, that's good enough for me, because that's what I heard over and over again, too.
You know, and Habit's been doing this since 1986.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. You know, we started in Knoxville at UT. We've gone up into Upper East Tennessee, down the South and East Tennessee through Chattanooga area, and now we're in middle. Something that makes people feel good. People report feeling happier. They enjoyed the visit. We actually did an interview for an alumni magazine kind of thing with some of the staff members that see the dogs when we go visit. And, you know, they said that literally it's the light at the end of the tunnel for them. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, we still need to work on it. Empirical evaluation, but I feel pretty good about what we're doing.
Oh, yeah. I got nothing but positive comments from the people that we would visit.
Yeah.
You were just talking a little while ago about it lighting up people's lives. And it was so cool to go into the children's home and to have the dogs sit down and get down on the ground and just talk to the dogs almost like it was their own pet.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing, especially with the teenagers that we see, this particular agency, they're all in custody, not just because of abuse, but sometimes because of their own legal issues. And some of these kids are pretty rough. And when we see them, it's because they've come into the agency to get their monthly one-on-one time with the nurse and just make like a health check kind of thing. And keeping them in one space while they're waiting is very hard. And they're willing to do it for the dog, which is amazing. But also, we've found a lot of these kids start talking about their own pets and what happened to their pets. And a lot of times the staff members have said, you know, we never heard that before. So we're getting more background on them and it's giving them more experience talking to an adult in a healthy way. So all around, it's a great experience.
Mm-hmm. In the past podcast episode, we were talking about pet loss and bereavement. And one of the things we discussed was how important it is to involve kids in any discussions regarding their animals. And, you know, because I'm hearing from my own clients now who are adults that all of the interactions with their animals were very, very important to them as they were growing up. And if adults didn't recognize that and decided, oh, we don't have space for this cat or this dog, it is really, really traumatic for these kids. And now, as adults, they're still going back and grieving the loss.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that paves the way for thinking about what is disposable, who is disposable within the house, within the family, and also trust. You know, I think for a long time, whenever a family did need to rehome or get rid of an animal, they lied and said, well, dog's out at the farm. We fed, or they went on an adventure and, or, you know, they didn't want to tell the kid that the animal died and they said the animal went to sleep. Well, you're talking to a small child that doesn't understand yet. That makes sleep very, very scary.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So animals provide us a lot of opportunities to develop our social and emotional health and well-being.
I totally agree. And language is so important.
It is, very much so.
And I'm really excited that there's more and more research being done on how this impacts kids, and there are more kids' books coming out on how to prepare for the loss or separation from an animal. You know, even kids going off to college, foster kids, you know, anybody.
Yeah. I know when I was in college, mom said the only reason I came to visit was to see my pets. So she wasn't exactly wrong.
So Bethany, looking at the work that you're doing, what do you need more of? You know, if you could just have some wish lists going, what would be helpful for you?
You know, I think we just need more awareness when it comes to the link. I think we need more collaboration between the animal side and the people side. We're starting to get that. We're starting to at least have those conversations. But, you know, I think we need to work more towards working together. It's not enough that just each side is aware of the connection. We need to start addressing the connection together.
Could I ask who those people would be? Who are the prime players, I guess, in that?
So, I mean, obviously, it depends what you're trying to accomplish, but our animal control officers, our veterinarians, our vet techs, but also our social workers, our mental health professionals, our nursing homes, our domestic violence service providers, our child abuse service providers, child and adult protective service. All those service providers on both sides need not only the education about the animal issues and the people issues, but also need to make our systems work together.
And there's strength in numbers and there's strength across agencies.
There really is. Mm-hmm. When I did my dissertation was actually on how animal welfare professionals deal with violence among people that they see while they're working. What are they seeing and how are they responding? And because we have some research about mental health professionals and social workers encountering animal violence while they're working and what they do about it. But there really wasn't anything about what the animal people see. And we found that, yeah, they do see it. And in some cases, they see it quite a bit. And in a lot of cases, they don't necessarily feel like they know what to do about it. So who do I call? What do I call about? Is this enough to call? And not necessarily knowing the rules. Like, how does this work? So, you know, making our systems so they're more comprehensive.
Well, I was even thinking about the hotline workers, and I used to get calls from, the hotline workers saying, I have this person that called and they're suicidal and they need to be in the hospital, but they're refusing right now. They don't have a plan or that, you know, they would have to take, you know, make sure that they got some help, but they wouldn't go in because of their pet. So the hotline worker is feeling very stressed out about what do I do to help?
Right. It gets to be a real challenge because, you know, we have legal definitions of animals, we have societal perceptions of animals, and we have that personal relationship with animals. So legally, in the United States, animals are mostly considered property. They're sentient property, but they're property. Society, we still have a lot of folks that say, well, it's a pet, so what? Or that, you know, it's just a dog, it's just a cat. And then when we get to the personal, that might be their baby, that might be their best friend, that might be their reason for living. So getting those to match, or at least working together, mm-hmm. is a challenge.
It's a huge challenge.
I was talking to some folks a few weeks ago, and we were just talking about pet-friendly apartments. Even discounting any other issue, just trying to find an apartment that you can afford that allows a pet is hard, you know? So if we add in those extra issues, it can be very overwhelming.
Well, and people, you know, going off to college or wanting to take their cats and their dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think there's arguments for and against that. We'd have to make some adjustments in how we house people for college. If you actually want them on campus. Now, obviously, if you're doing your own living situation off campus, that's different. But I used to be a resident assistant in my dorm when I was in college. And I'm just trying to imagine all the craziness that happened and then adding like 10 dogs on a floor.
Yeah.
It's like, how would we manage that?
Well, there are more and more people that are wanting, you know, they're saying that they need to have their emotional support dog with them at college. You know, it does reduce anxiety.
Yeah, it really can. You know, it's not a bad idea. There's also practicalities that go with it too. So how do we balance those?
So we could try to resolve all these issues, Bethany. We could have a great conversation trying to. These are really important
right?
things to discuss. Bethany, how is COVID affecting what you do in your programs?
COVID has been a challenge. So we had to suspend visits starting in March. The summer, we decided that per agency, we might be able to do some visits if we worked out guidelines and had strict rules. But it turns out most of our agencies have decided that they're still not ready. They're really limiting to essential personnel only. So we've been working on finding other ways to get involved. We do some virtual visits, specifically with the Family Safety Center, their staff. Personally, I think that works for us because we have the same volunteers going and now they're online. So these are people they know. These are dogs they know. So they get some time to kind of ooh and aah over the dog and how cute it's being. But it's also a person that they're used to talking to. And a lot of their staff are working from home, and so they're not getting that social interaction. So it's actually fun for them. They get to see somebody new, but also see some of their coworkers that they haven't gotten to see in a long time. We've also really upped our social media. We make sure we have something on our Facebook page at least once every day, whether it's a cute picture or some sort of informative article or self-care article, that kind
of thing. Just to stay connected?
Just to stay connected. You know, our volunteers are missing it too. So getting to see something. And also, you know, there's some studies that show looking at cuteness, particularly cute animals, can help your brain. So I think everybody needs that right now.
Definitely.
So, and also we've made some little activity sheets that I found a free puzzle maker online. Cool. So like word searches. And so I have a picture of our habit dog and then a little story, you know, saying, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm a habit dog. These are my favorite foods, and this is what I like to do. And so it still gets us out there, and it's something that we have on a Google Drive folder, and all of our agencies can access it and print them out as they want to. If they have a kid that needs distraction, that's something they can do. We're working on it.
We're all doing the best we can, right?
Exactly. I have been doing more webinars, more education than I typically do, which is still important.
Yeah, it's very important. Yeah. We miss that human contact, though, right? Like human and animal actually being in one room.
Yes. I have not petted a dog in person in months. I personally have cats.
So. They're very different.
They are. I do love them, but I also miss my dogs. So
Bethany, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us today? We've covered a lot.
We have. Yeah, we sort of went the whole gamut. I wish I had some sort of profound ending statement. I don't think I really do.
Well, you do a lot of great work. And, you know, I hope you know that. I appreciate the work that you do. It's very, very difficult work, but it's much needed. And I'm glad that you found your passion when you were in that program. It's interesting how those light bulb moments then steer you on the path of where you need to be.
Exactly. Yeah, this was definitely not the plan.
It usually never is. But I found that myself, too.
Yeah. Right.
So if people want to reach you, it's going to be in our show notes, the resources and the links to whatever you talked about today. What's the best way for people to reach you if they have questions?
So I'm an email addict. So go ahead and send me an email at habitmt. So it's habitmt at utk.edu.
Awesome. And again, we're going to put those in the show notes. If anybody wants to contact
you,
you'll be getting some emails. And I loved looking at the website. I enjoyed that. You've got some very creative things on there.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Yeah, you can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/humananimalbondintennessee. And that's one of our more active pages.
Well, thank you. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode of the Animal Academy podcast. It's never easy to hear about the challenges people face as part of life, and equally difficult to hear stories about animals who also become victims as a result of difficult life experiences. But it's a reality. And I have to thank those individuals who are able to help people overcome their traumas and who also appreciate the connection they have with animals and then use that as part of the healing process. During this podcast, we heard over and over about the power of animals. And my goal has been to share the human experiences and how we're all interconnected. Animals play a significant role in many of our lives in various ways. When people experience adverse life experiences, the power of animals becomes evident and significant in helping people recover. It's the safe connection, unconditional love, and presence that promotes the healing. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Animal Academy podcast and for continuing to appreciate the special connection we have with our animals. I would love to hear about your own stories, so please feel free to contact me at animalacademy.com or join our Animal Academy Facebook group. Thanks, everyone, and stay tuned for the next episode where I will wrap up the year of 2020 and welcome in the new year. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Animal Academy podcast. Detailed contact information and links for each of the guests and resources provided inside this episode can be found at my website, animalacademypodcast.com. I'm Allison White, licensed clinical social worker specializing in the human-animal connection. Let's share and learn from the animals in the next episode of the Animal Academy Podcast.